So we are quite 2 weeks into the new year, and the rock and roll is already going. It's awesome. I was thinking this morning that I grew up kind of on the tail end of this. Take the drum with you. Awesome. Because I think every kid should be able to drum. Just not while I'm trying to talk. What I was going to say is actually kind of pertains to this. I was looking around this morning and I was thinking I grew up with this adage that kids should be seen and not heard. Some of you may be familiar with this adage. And I was thinking that at the table, apparently we believe almost the exact opposite. Anyway.
Heard but not seen.
Should be heard but not seen. You ever feel like this whole concept of New Year kind of has it's kind of pinned to the concept of a do-over? I know that I feel like that sometimes. I kind of have this vague sensation, you know, that what I get at the turn of the year is another chance, right? It's another shot at it. And if I had to, I could make a partial list. I could never be exhaustive, but I'm pretty sure I could make a partial list of last year's debacles and failures. Some are more memorable than others, and the worst ones are the easiest to remember. It's kind of like this law of inverse proportions. You know, the more you want to shake off something, the stickier it is. Failure, I think, kind of can feel like that. And so what my experience often is around this whole New Year's thing and the idea of a fresh start is that I feel like I'm sort of heading into the New Year with this vague hope that I'll do better, you know, or that it'll be better. And part of what I think I mean when I imagine a New Year like that, part of what I think is going on inside of me is that I'm sort of hoping that someone else is going to show up to live my life in my skin in a world that looks a lot like the one I was living in last year, but without last year's dilemmas and suffering, you know? Something like that is going on inside of me when I come into a new year like that. And so far, I have to tell you, so far, a couple weeks in, that has not been happening. And I think, you know, some of us have this in common. One of the first pieces of personal mail that came in New Year was from a friend of ours, a friend named Mia, someone I've talked about here before. Mia is one of the most lovely human beings that I know. And I know some pretty lovely human beings. The bar is pretty high. I wish I had time to tell you the story of how she met the man that is her husband, because it reads like a movie script. It really is this remarkable story about people involved with humanitarian aid in the middle of war zones and different countries and letters and friends that happen to know someone and chance meetings in airports. And it's just, if I didn't know it was true, I'd kind of go, that's melodramatic. But it is true. It's an amazing story. And her and her husband Jim live in her home country of Sweden with their three girls. Jim's been ill. We've been praying for him and for them here on more than one occasion. So we got this Christmas card slightly after Christmas from Mia. I know this is the right story, so just bear with me if it gets hard to tell. We got this letter from her, and it was lovely to hear from her. And in the card, one of the things she wrote was this. She wrote, "Jim's illness is getting worse. I know I won't be growing old along with him." Takes a while to catch your breath when you think about it. And sometimes there are these moments, you know, in the middle of this do-over wish of a new year, there are these moments where you go, not only do I not know what to pray, I don't even know what kind of prayer to pray. One of my favorite bands is a band called Over the Rhine. Really thoughtful husband and wife duo. Just great songwriters, these people. Had a chance to see them in concert a couple years ago, and Karen, who sort of fronts the band most of the time, told this story. It's just a crazy funny story. Morning, Frank.
Morning.
Told this crazy funny story about her mom's care home and the characters, the cast of characters in this home. And, I mean, I don't have time to relay the whole story, but a couple of highlights is there's this woman named Barb who loves to, like, raid the med cart. You know, when the nurse turns her back, she just kind of, I'll take some of those. She's always ripping off random meds. So the guy who's, because of what's going on with his mental health, he needs a busy apron. So he has his busy apron on, so he's got something to do with his hands all the time. But he really enjoys coming out with nothing on under his busy apron. And it just went on from there. It was just this woman who just burst into the Hallelujah chorus, you know, whenever. Just this whole cast of kind of intriguing and slightly madcap, you know, and also just very normal aging people in the story. And then she sang the song, the chorus of which, the hook of which is the line, "Only God can save us now." And so for the first couple of verses, she's kind of retelling all these old people's stories, and only God can save us now. And you kind of go, oh, I get the chronological logic of that, right? You know, we kind of get old, and all the things that we could do for ourselves, we lose our capacity to do, and the obvious default is to say, over to you, God, I'm all used up. And then, and this is one of the reasons I love these guys as songwriters, and then Karen inserts her own story into the song and says, my turn's coming, and it might not be real far away, and it's kind of going to go like this. I'm going to want some Prozac with my milk, and if you can sneak me in some whiskey, that'd be awesome. You know, and she just kind of lays it out and says, don't be surprised if you show up and I'm howling at the moon. Like, it's, you know, only God can save us now. We can push that space away, right? Like, we can act like that is for somebody else. Some other class of person, some other particular person, some other age and stage, some other circumstance. But then we open the mail, you know, or our phone buzzes, or we get a Facebook update, and there it is. This is not somebody else's story. Poet Rumi writes, does sunset sometimes look like the sun is coming up? Do you know what a faithful love is like? You're crying, you say you've burned yourself. But can you think of anyone who's not hazy with smoke? This is not somebody else's story. And so when we open the mail and we read that from Mia, from our friend, and we follow up and we get some more details, and we've prayed and others have prayed and this community's prayed, and God only knows how Mia and her daughters have prayed for Jim to be healed and miracles happen, and so we ask, and when we ask and they don't happen, does that mean God's not listening? Does that mean this thing we call prayer is pretty much just an exercise in a sort of self-soothing futility? It's a comfort to speak words into what? And when we ask a question like that, what is this thing that we do when we pray? How we answer that might have a lot to do with what we think prayer is or what we've seen people behave it as. I have a friend whose dad is a pastor. And his dad's kind of one of these larger-than-life characters, right? And he's one of these guys who, this friend of mine doesn't really like to eat out with his family because his dad's one of those guys who stands up to pray in restaurants. And he doesn't pray in restaurants like for the people he's with. He prays for the whole restaurant. He prays for the neighborhood it's in, you know. And he starts out with some good theology. Like, but so you know it's good. Our Father, our omnipotent God who sees all of us here today. He just like embraces the whole, you know. And depending on your personality, you might kind of go, this is my slightly quirky father. Or you might go, dear God, I'm so glad there's a long thing on this table because I could fit underneath. You know, and I just don't want to be here. I want to disappear. And he says now, like as an adult, he says, he doesn't, I mean, imagine him as an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old, right? It's just, anyway. He says now he doesn't believe that his dad was trying to pray as a kind of advertisement about what he believed, which I think there was a long period in his life where that would sort of be the critique. It was like, you know, just, do you really have to broadcast that? But he says, no, he doesn't believe that's what's going on. He just thinks it was his dad's way of being authentic to what he believed. It was a genuine thing. But if that's what comes to mind, as it does for my friend, when I ask the question, what is this thing that we call prayer? Not only might I admit that I don't do it, but I really might not want to. Because that's not, there's no attraction to that for me. So what I want us to do, because it's a big question and it's a big idea, what I want us to do is kind of back the truck up a little bit and consider what might be some alternative or thought-provoking ideas about what prayer is. And one of the reasons I want to try to get underneath the thing that presents itself in prayer is because we don't have to travel far or get into some sort of esoteric, unlikely story to encounter the dilemma, right? We encountered it already this morning. Would somebody like to pray for such and so? Somebody like to pray about what just got shared into our lives as a community? And maybe somebody does, and maybe somebody doesn't. And maybe we're silent, and when we're silent, is that prayer? And when somebody speaks, is that a different thing? And there's so many presenting versions of the thing that I want to try to get underneath that a little bit. And it seems to me that at the core of it, ultimately, if we wanted to try to get at the essence of the thing that we use a word like prayer for, one of the things we could say about it is that in the end, it's private. And what I mean by that is that ultimately prayer isn't what we say. It's actually an attempt for our heart to communicate with the essence of some being that is not us. I think one of the results of that way of thinking about prayer for me is that I've come to believe that a lot of times we're praying when we don't know or think that we're praying. And as a guy who spent a lot of his life standing in front of groups of people where I can see them, I've come to the conclusion that, among other things, our bodies sometimes pray when our conscious minds aren't. What if the thing that we call prayer is what is happening when we don't have words because the feelings inside of us have just overwhelmed our ability to articulate what's going on inside of us? What if tears, among other things, are an outward expression of a cry of the heart that is so passionate that words utterly fail to serve it well or adequately? What if leaning in is the same thing? I spent all day, I mean, I have this business as a photographer, right? So I spent all day Friday photographing this uber fit woman. She's an adventure in itself. Larger than life personality. She runs this company called Fluid Isometrics, which works with posture and yoga and anyway, I won't bother explaining her whole business. I watched this very fit person all day in the realm of what you do with your body has a lot to do with, like, with your wellness. And halfway through the day, I asked her, I said, Deanna, how did you end up doing this? Oh, she said, I didn't find this, it found me. I was from the time I was 17 to the time I was 30, I was a blackout drunk with all kinds of health issues, with an eating disorder. My profession was I was an athletic therapist, and one day I was trying something that I wanted to use with one of my clients on myself, and I realized this is the path. Anyway, I won't retell you the whole story. But I spent a lot of the day just watching her be conscious of her posture, of how her body was, what her alignment was. The dancers are nodding. Yeah. And I was thinking about prayer, because I was thinking about this, right? And the tears were the obvious one to me. When the inside of us just runs out to the outside, and if we had to try to put words around it, we would fumble it. We just wouldn't find enough words. And I started thinking, well, that's the above the waterline, no pun intended about the tears there, but that's the above the waterline part of it, right? But what about all the subtler versions of this? What if that's prayer? What if these, Anthony, you and I, maybe it's brother in our bloodline, what if these are prayer? I said to my mom, I thought I was a kid, are you mad? She said, no, it's just my face looks. There were four of us. I don't know what was going on in the house. It's like, oh, good. Is that ever going to go back to the other way it used to look? Maybe not. What if the pacing I see at the back of the room sometimes, in this room. What if that's prayer? What if that's a body trying to find a way to say something essential to a being that is not dead?
I realize, you know what? My own thoughts about whether I pray or whether I don't start to shift when I start to change what I think prayer is and what it all encompasses, what it all embraces, what I'm trying to do when I do the thing that I would use a word like prayer for. Because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get something essential to me, something that's from my heart, from the center of my being, soul, use whatever word we want to use for that essence. I'm trying to get something that is from there to connect with the being that I use a word like God for. That's what I'm after.
That's what I'm longing for. That's what I'm calling prayer. And not only do I think increasingly that all of that can be prayer, but I think some of that can be the most authentic prayer that we engage in. But so can the things we make noise about. So can yelling or whispering the deep kind of things about God that we think, you know, if people knew this about me, they would just run for, as Anne Lamott says, run for their cute little lives. And I don't know what kind of things you've yelled at God, but God, I hate you comes immediately in my mind. And it would be followed closely by, you confuse me. I said I was going to reference this little book of Anne Lamott's in the next few weeks, Help, Thanks, Wow, The Three Essential Prayers. And in that book, Lamott says this about some of those ideas. She says, my belief is that when you're telling the truth, you're close to God. If you say to God, I'm exhausted and depressed beyond words and I don't like you at all right now and I recoil from most people who believe in you, that might be the most honest thing you've ever said. And if you told me that you had said to God, it's all hopeless, I don't have a clue if you exist, but I could use a hand, it would almost bring tears to my eyes, tears of pride in you for the courage it takes to get really real. It would make me want to sit next to you at the dinner table. If telling the truth, if Lamott is on about a true idea, if telling the truth can put us in proximity to God, then honestly, most of us would probably have to admit that either the first prayer or one of the most direct and maybe most honest prayers that we've ever prayed is the prayer that Lamott names first in the book, which is help. Just that. Don't remember the title of the movie, but many years ago, I don't know, would have been maybe an early college student, movie about this young guy, he gets into all sorts of trouble. It's sort of this vaguely Middle Ages world, and he keeps making bargains with God the whole way through the movie. Some of us remember those bargains, how'd our end go. But the prayer that started them tended to be something like that prayer, right? Help. What is it about a prayer like help that puts it so close to the core of what prayer really is? Maybe it's that help is a prayer that we don't pray when we are still laboring under the misapprehension that we can fix the unfixable. I know I've told you stories before about this one gymnastics coach that my daughter Taya has that has so impressed me as a person. Taya and I were back at gymnastics for the first time, that is, I took her to gymnastics for the first time since before Christmas last week, and Teresa, this coach, was there. And Teresa's a fit person and a trim person, and I walked in and I was like, damn, I think Teresa's pregnant. But it's not the kind of thing you want to be wrong about, you know. And it was just after Christmas. And so she just barely, you know. And so Taya and I kind of whispered about it. And then she went off with her little buddies to do things with their little bodies that I can't even imagine, you know. And I sat there and I watched her for a while. And I sort of was surreptitiously watching Teresa as well. And when Teresa was watching the kids, and she wasn't thinking about it, did this, and I thought, okay, I can just walk up to her now and say, how far along is that? Because it's like this universal beep, beep, right? You know? Every pregnant woman I've ever known has done that. And so that was kind of, for me, that's kind of settled it. But I was just watching, and a few minutes later, Teresa came over and sat down beside me and kind of spilled the beans, first baby due in May. Everyone's excited. It's going great. It's awesome. And then, and this is why I like Teresa so much. And then we just kind of, she had minutes. I mean, she was in the middle of coaching these kids. And then we just kind of dove right in. And we started talking about her husband, Colin, and what this experience is like for him and how he worries about her because she doesn't really want to slow down. She's this fit, active person, and she'd like to just heave all the things in the gymnastics club around like she always does. And so he's, that kind of stresses him out. And we wound up having this conversation about the different experiences of men and women when they're expecting. I mean, I can't even start to imagine the interior experience of growing a child. You know, it doesn't matter how close you are to the person that's growing the baby. You just can't go there as a guide. It's bleh. Can't. But I'm all over the experience her husband was having about being distressed about her experience. Because if it's true that, you know, as a man I don't have the womb to grow the child, it seems just as true that there's something as intrinsic to me as a womb that makes me want to fix what's busted in the world. Or that might bust. Or that's in danger of breaking. That's what we prayed about when we prayed for Jennifer. Right? It's like it's that thing where as a guy, there's nothing that makes me crazier that I can think of in the world than somebody I love being in possible harm's way and being able to do nothing about it. I mean, we can be supportive, we can be empathetic, we can say breathe, we can whatever. Okay? It's like this, if there's a human essence that is right next to my heart, this is it. And if things go sideways in this, I am the cab driver. Huh! Okay. Thanks for showing up for my therapy. We want to fix things. We want to fix things that aren't fixable. So what do we do when we get into that space in life? Well, however we get there, whatever the moment is, whatever the circumstance is, whatever it is that brings us to this place where all that's left is this reorienting prayer that I'm summing up with the word help. One of the reasons why I think that's a good prayer is because it reminds us of all of that. It reminds me of who I am and who I am not. This old joke that says that the one mistake God is never going to make is thinking that he is me. Which is, you have to read it backwards for it to be a joke, I guess. But it puts me in my place. That prayer reminds me of who I am not. And that there are limits to my causal will. There are limits to the things that I can and cannot do. So when I acknowledge in my own heart that I can't fix Jim, that I can't just try harder and somehow draw the sorrow out of Mia's I won't grow old with Jim. Or I can't really offer what feels like meaningful reassurance to a family of young women who are watching their once physically powerful and robust and able dad decline in strength until already he has to be wheeled around in a wheelchair. Mia has the kind of strength of character that in the face of all of this would say to Jim, as she has said, now I can make you go wherever I want. She's, you know. When I think about that, when I acknowledge those things, when I think about the lives in this community and the lives of people that I know, when I think about the stories we've shared here this morning, I think we can all fill in that blank with what is unfixable. We can ask ourselves the same question about what the story is in our life that lands there. I can't fix this. But when we do that, we might want to do it in private because it could be a bit shattering, but when we do it, one of the reasons we do it is because to not do it means that we are staying in a place that denies the reality of only God can save us now. And the space of only God can save us now is the space where the prayer, help, lives. This isn't a new story, of course. This is an old story. And if we're wondering how old it is, I would point you to the book of Job, which I think I could fairly sum up by saying Job is suffering, to put it mildly. He complains to God and demands an explanation. God says, any snappy explanation you come up with, Job, is bullshit. And if I told you how this really works, you wouldn't understand. And then the buddies show up to try to explain it, and that's the story. This is an old problem. Maybe, rather than coming to the thing we call prayer with our list, it would do us good if we start to ask God, in the context of a prayer like help, for things that are closer to the essence of life than the things that we've been asking for before. Maybe we need to start asking for things in people's lives and in our lives that are more like what we might call light or oxygen, essence of life kind of things, and looking for them. Maybe we need to start to pray for the kinds of things that keep us alive and foster healing at the center of life. I'm not going to suggest what those might be. I don't think that would be a fair or wise thing to do. But so that we can leave some of these thoughts with a little bit to work on, two things. In Philippians 4, Paul's talking about prayer, and he uses this little phrase in trying to describe God. And the phrase is, transcends all understanding. That's a pretty good description of God. The rest of it is mostly the things that we make up to put handles on that. But then Paul goes on to say, don't get stuck. Talk to the being that transcends our understanding about all the things that transcend yours. All the unbreakables that we can't seem to fix. And by the way, these will be the things, Paul says, that are true and noble and right and pure and lovely and admirable and excellent and praiseworthy. When we walk out of here this morning, we will, if we try, we will see some of the things that we would call lovely and good and right. We will, in our own limited human way, encounter other people whom we choose to trust, and with whom we experience the thing that we call trustworthiness, and we can keep going. Maybe the shift, at least for me, maybe the shift is away from saying, God, would you fix this? To something more like, would you help me see that in this? Would you help those that I love that are suffering to touch that, those things in this? C.S. Lewis, of course, famously suggested that prayer doesn't change God's mind, it changes ours. And maybe that's what this is about. Maybe that's what those ideas are about. Drawing on an idea of the Mott's here, let me make this suggestion as maybe a more particular starting point. Sometime this week, take a few minutes, longer than a stoplight, shorter than a coffee break, a if you're a parent, you know that stoplights, you can get a lot accomplished at a stoplight. You can have an entire sleep at a stoplight. Just make sure your kids don't think it's funny to tell you the light's green when it isn't. Sometime, take a few minutes. That was a whoop. We're back. Take a few minutes to consider this. In order to begin praying help, Lamont suggests that we need to admit what he calls the three most terrible truths of our existence. That we are so ruined, and so loved, and in charge of so little. And out of those, the consideration of those ideas as terrible essential truths, see what sort of prayer that you could sum up as help comes to you. And don't be afraid to believe that that prayer, whatever shape it has, is essential in the sense that it comes from the center of who you are, from your heart, and that it reaches toward the center, the heart, of who God is. And beyond that, perhaps we're back in the train of the third terrible truth, where we control so little. Peace.